Great. Thanks, Vincent. Well, welcome, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the Review of All Rights Protectionism Subteam for Data call on the 5th of January, 2018. On the call today, we do have Rebecca Tushnet, J. Scott Evans, Christine Durain, Philip Corwin, Kurt Pritz, Lori Shulman, Kathy Kleiman. We have apologies from Susan Payne, but Michael Graham will be joining us later into the meeting. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Julie Headland, Barry Cobb, Ariel Liang, Antonietta and Nagia Kennedy, and myself, Michelle DeSnyder. As a reminder, please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and you may begin.
So this is Julie Headland from staff. Just to remind everybody where we left off, we did leave off during in Michael's section. So we would like to have him pick up from where he was. So that's closing out the trademark/brand owner section, cease and desist letters and brand owner experiences regarding evidence of harm. That's pages 18 to 20 of the Google Doc. And we do have the link to the Google Doc up in the notes pod. And then once we follow from Michael, we can then start into the registrant section, which is, or the registrar section, Susan. But since Susan's not on the call, and I don't think she's anticipated to join given the time, we could move into Kurt's section. So I see that we don't have Michael yet. But we do know that he does plan to be here. Perhaps if no one minds, I'll just remind everybody of the agenda today, as I've done a little bit here, but starting with the TM brand owner section, Michael to lead, then discussion of registrant section, Kurt to lead, agree on document management methods, and then the timing for the next call. So I also am still not seeing and again, this is Julie Headland from staff. Christine Durain was asking. I see Lori is asking about fixing the screen view. This is the way the screen view is for the Adobe Connect rooms. What you have to do, though, is we have unsynced the document, and if you click on the little the minus button below the screen, you can then shift it so that it will be smaller and more viewable. Or you can also download the doc, as Kathy is noting. Since I'm still not seeing Michael, I'm wondering if we should go ahead and start in the registrant section. Kurt, would that be okay with you? I see Christine has her hand up. Please go ahead, Christine.
Hi, this is Christine. And if Kurt wants to jump to the next section, that's fine. I don't really have strong feelings about it, but I think that if Michael's anticipated to join us shortly, I would like to second Jay Scott's suggestion in the chat that we start with the document management issue, because I think that could be quickly resolved. And then if he's going to show up quickly, then we can just stay on track. If not, if you think he's going to be like a half hour late, then maybe we should just jump ahead to Kurt. I just thought I would throw that out there because Jay Scott suggested it in the chat. Thanks.
Thank you, Christine. This is Julie Headland again from staff. And thank you for that helpful suggestion and also to Jay Scott. And I'm sorry to miss that in the chat, Jay Scott. Michael did say he was just coming off of another call and that he would just be a few minutes late. So if there's no objections, perhaps we can skip to the document management methods question that staff raised in an email about a half an hour or so before the call. Let me just speak to that again here. For general document management going forward, staff would like to ask the group to agree on whether to continue to use the Google Doc as the authoritative document with insertions and additions to be placed into it, and staff can assist if you need us to, and whether and when to lock the Google Doc prior to each subteam call so that everyone is clear when we start the call about the exact version we're looking at
for that day. Note that staff has locked this particular document, as we noted, before this call, just so that we knew we were all in the same place. So those are the two questions that we'd like to put forward to the subteam. Thank you. Please go ahead, Christine.
Thanks. This is Christine for the transcript. I want to ask a clarifying question, and maybe Kirk's going to jump in with the answer to my clarifying question. Is the problem that some people's changes essentially changed over what was originally there? Because I'm looking at the Google Doc, and I see some things are on the side of suggestion, like words comment feature, which allows like all the comments to stay on the right but doesn't change the original text. And in other cases, I think the text has actually changed. And so it's unclear to me who has the power to sort of write over, to delete, to move, versus just add a comment on the right. And is that really the problem? Because I thought that what I read about what Kurt said was some of his work was actually taken out, or and maybe I misunderstood that. So I'll back out now, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm sort of struggling with what the question is. Thanks.
Hi, this is Kurt. So part of this discussion is largely my doing, but I think we're in somewhat of a unique situation because each of us took turns. We divided up the section and we each took ownership of a section and wrote the questions we thought would be applicable to that question. And then for the first couple of sections, we went through the original writing and through interaction on call, marked it up. But also, many people marked up my section, and not that I have any ego about it, but when it came time for me to anticipate leading the call, I went through the questions and found them, not only to be changed, but to be somewhat unrecognizable, so I wouldn't be the best one to take us through the questions. So my point, I think, is because we should only change a question when we know why a question is written a certain way. It's like breaking rules, right? You can't break the rules until you know why the rule is written. So, I think for this case, we want to somehow preserve the work that each person did in formulating the questions and have, she or he, explain and perhaps defend why they wrote them that way and then take comments. But I understand completely the need for some sort of expediency in, anticipating what comments might be before the meeting and not waiting. So that's kind of the balancing that needs to be done.
Thanks, Kurt.
Christine commented, if all the changes were in comment form and the original writing was there, that would be one way to go about that.
Thanks, Kurt. This is Mary from staff. Julie is dialing back in, so I'm just stepping in for a bit. But, Kathy, you had your hand up next, and then after Kathy, I'm going to ask Ariel to maybe go over what the crossouts and comments mean in the Google Doc. Kathy, please go ahead.
Thanks, Mary. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Always good to test the first time. Hi, everybody. Happy New Year. This is Kathy. And just wanted to point out that I believe the original drafter was Rebecca. And so that we should be, that if there's an initial presentation of the section, it should probably be Rebecca. And that it was, a surprise to wake up, I think, the morning of the call and find a number of changes to this section that had literally happened in the middle of the night. And so that was a surprise. And then the discussion that Kurt had said that the machine had crashed. And so uncertain whether we're looking at all of Kurt's revisions or not, or what the situation was. So I'd like to recommend kind of a discussion with Rebecca and Kurt on this so that we kind of know where things stand. Thank you.
And this is Ariel Lam from staff. Since I'm the author of this Google Doc, meaning I have the editing rights and everyone else have the commenting rights, I just want to make a few clarifications to the Google Doc. So all the changes discussed during the call, staff incorporate them, but they're all in red line, so meaning we are also using the comments function. And even you see the text is reflected, like the editor reflected within a text, but they're in a different color. That means they're new, but the original text is still there. And even there's the illusion of original text based on the suggestions. You can see like a line crossing it. So you can always see the original there, and it's, nothing has been changed from the text, and all the changes are redlined. So that's the first clarification. And then the second clarification regarding what Kathy just mentioned about the crash and the new text added by Kurt that happened, I think it's December the 15th. And basically, as the editor, I could see all the version changes, and then I was able to track to the original version or the version dated back to 15th of December before all the crash happened and reverted back to it. So, and then Kurt also confirmed that was the correct version he wanted staff to revert back to. So nothing is lost there. So that's the two clarification right here.
And I see Rebecca.
This is Kurt. Go ahead.
I see Rebecca has her hand up. Rebecca?
Sorry, Rebecca Tushnet. I just wanted to say what I said in the chat, which is I don't know why Google Docs did it this way, but Kurt's crash did interfere with my section, which is right behind his. So, that's all. He didn't do anything wrong. But whatever posting Google Docs made it not save, it also affected my stuff. And so I had to go back in. Thank you.
This is Julie Hedlund from staff. Thank you, Rebecca. And I think I heard Kurt.
Yeah, thanks. So I think, Kathy, so this might be a gross misunderstanding on my part, but I think our comments kind of just went by one another. So my point was that whoever authored a section should get to present that section in its original form before changes are made. So my last minute changes were actually to try to remember what more of the original form was so that I could talk to that. And I think you were kind of saying the same thing, that there shouldn't be changes at the last minute. But I I think we were addressing two different issues. Well, I didn't put that well, but I hope you understand.
And it's Julie Hedlund from that staff. Thank you, Kurt. And I'll just note that Michael has joined us. So I do see a couple of more people with hands up. Rebecca, I still see your hand up. I don't know if that's new or old. And then I see Kathy. Now I see Lori and Kathy. Lori, please.
Yes, hi. Good evening, everybody. I want to second something Kurt has raised about the original drafter being the presenter. I strongly support that. I just have to say from personal experience in working in a sub-team where we were having issues and questions about when staff might have added or others might have added to a Google Doc when I, as the lead, was ready to present and then looked at something entirely different. It's super frustrating. And I think in this, when we have to be so careful about the detail of the question, that we ensure that the person who's responsible for that section is the shepherd of the section. I think that's crucial. I would suggest perhaps that we think about closing the document 6 hours before the meeting. The reason that I say six is that there's many, including myself, who tend not to prepare for the meeting until maybe an hour or two before the meeting. I mean, it's just the reality of dealing, and I know there are many people here who are very active ICANNers and we're on several work plenary meeting on Wednesdays. So I think it's a bit much to close it any earlier than that, because I don't think that's the way people work, unless other people have differences about that. But I think it would be fair to close 6 hours before, and then at least you have a half a day, a half a work day more or less, to look at the what's ever been inserted into the document up to that point.
Thank you, Lori. I see Kathy, please.
I think 6 hours may give a lot of advantage to people not, you know, Europe and Asia, because it gives them the whole day. So let's think about something that would fairly be a cutoff for everyone, so everyone could see it. Because otherwise, it means, you know, a bunch of us wake up on the East Coast with a number of changes. So I'm still trying to understand Section 4, Survey of Domain Name Registrants. Kurt, if you were the original drafter, then, I mean, I've reviewed this section a number of times as we went through kind of the other sections. I would just skim it in case we got to it in some of our prior meetings. And there were a number of questions that have been part of it for weeks, or at least it appeared that way. And then I see a number of crossouts the night before. Kurt, sorry if you've already said this, could you help me out with what was happening here? So you're saying your original got edited in a way that you didn't agree to, and that you didn't like the edits and found out the night before? Is that because a lot of these edits had been there for a long time, if my memory serves? Thanks.
Right, so essentially the night before the meeting, which was well in advance of 6 hours, but the night before the meeting, I pulled up the document to review it in the event that we got to that section in our agenda and didn't recognize some of the questions. So went back to the questions I had originally proposed, put back some of the ones that were deleted, and then added some of my, you know, kept some of the other questions, but edited those to make them what I thought was a little more clear. But then again, preparing for this meeting, I noted that there were additional edits to the questions. So I thought, you know, rather than doing that again for exactly the reasons you're saying, Kathy, I decided, well, I'll just, you know, put the original questions or the questions that I think there should be in a Word document so I can make my original presentation, and then we can, you know, consider the markups if that was a way to be helpful to the group. You know, the other way is just to start with the document the way it's been edited.
This is Julie Hedlund from staff, just putting myself in the queue, and I don't see anybody else here right at the moment. So we're hearing a suggestion and some agreements for a cutoff of 6 hours, closing the Google Doc for edits 6 hours before the call. There seems to be agreement that we would continue to use the Google Doc. I guess just one question staff might have is it goes to a point that you made, Kurt, whereby you had drafted questions and then there were edits to the questions. Staff should note that that actually the original questions were still there, but or they should still be seen. We didn't take them out. I mean, there would be edits to them. But I guess my question from staff is, and I think you were making this point perhaps. So if someone has been the original drafter and has not had the opportunity to speak to, you know, to present those questions, should we suggest then that there should not be edits to the questions until they have been presented by the drafter? That's a question. Go ahead, Kurt.
Yeah, so first, I want to say that I'm probably the worst in this group by far at keeping track of versions and checking to see when changes are made and not made. But I think that when I read the questions before the meeting, they looked different. They were different ones I had proposed, and some of the ones I had proposed were lined out. So I was pretty sure there were changes. To me, there's a way that comments could be made without lineouts showing, so it's really clear what the original text is. I think, excuse me, I think that's the preferable way, so it's easy to see what the original text is, and then people could make comments alongside of that. But if that can't be done without, you know, some sort of lineout showing, then that's more problematic. But anyway, yeah, so I think we should be able to comment to documents but not edit them until they're discussed.
Thank you very much, Kurt. And I see Christine. Please go ahead.
Thanks. This is Christine for the transcript. I support everything Kurt just said. I just wanted to note, because I was the one that already did her section, and I did notice that when people put in their own comments, either during the call or shortly before or shortly after, there was always a little bit of, I had to keep really careful to find out if that was just a suggestion that another sub-team member had made that we had decided to go on with as a group, or if we had decided against it. You know, they had thrown it out there for discussion, but we had decided to go a different direction. So there's a little bit of danger, even with adding comments before the drafter has had a chance to go through it. And that's only because it's hard to keep track. And I know the date function helps, the date and time function. But it was really kind of tricky to make sure that we captured where the group landed on each of those comments on the right-hand side. So not that I disagree. I mean, I do agree. I think that if we're going to have comments, if we're going to have a lot of changes, we should force them to be comments and not redline. But at the same time, I also just caution, having gone through this with myself a few weeks ago, that even that in and of itself is not entirely foolproof, because we can lose track of, you know, how valid those comments still are a week or two later. Just one suggestion there. Thanks.
Thank you, Christine. I see Ariel. I think she wants to speak to the Google Doc functioning. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. This is Ariel speaking. So just want to clarify about the comments in Google Docs. So it may be that people may have different understanding of that. So comment does not only mean you can highlight a phrase and then insert a comment and put it on the right. It means you can also directly edit the text, but whatever you put in will be in a different color. Like if you add a phrase, it will be in a different color. If you delete a sentence or word, there will be a colored line across the text. So these are all comments. And so I think that's kind of maybe that caused the confusion. Why some people saying we can see, you know, on the right there's comments, and then sometimes you see these crossed out also part of the commenting function. And I hope that helped clarify this. And just remember that orange text is there and must have been deleted from the Google Doc.
Thank you, Ariel. And I see that staff has suggested in the chat that perhaps the group agrees to use one form of editing, and I see Christine has said, yes, I propose that we not allow insertions and strikeouts in the text, and Michael Graham has his hand up. Please go ahead, Michael.
Thanks, Julie. Yeah, I'm noting in the chat the discussion of making comments rather than write-in comments or changes, and the difficulty with that is just the amount of drafting that takes place. And I had a quick question in that regard to Ariel, which I think might address the issue that we're facing, and that is, Ariel, do you know if Google Docs has the ability to retain the document but show you the document without the changes and then be able to go back so that way the document that's been saved and that people are moving in to comment on or editing, that original document is still there even though there's a second document that we've been editing on top of it. Do you know if there's that ability to do that, or does that create a problem of as soon as you've entered those things, if somebody accepts it, it does away with the original document, which I guess, Kurt, is what you faced.
Thanks for the question. This is Ariel speaking. So I do need to investigate a little further, but what I understood is that if you want to view this document as a clean doc, you will go all the way back to the very first version, which is the version on 27th of November. And we can see it. Like if I change the rights to all the people on the Google Doc to view only, you will see the 27th of November without any comments or suggestions. But probably that's not what we wanted to do. But I can look further into that and then see how to change the view from red line to clean version and, you know, different versions of clean version that I do into a check. I hope that answers part of the question.
Yeah, that's real useful. I mean, my problem is, Michael, again, my problem with doing the comments on the side is that generally the comments I want to make are just minor revisions or something to language, and it takes an awful lot more to explain what the change would be than to just put it in there. So thanks for taking a look at that, Ariel.
This is Julie Hedlund from staff. Thanks, everyone, for this discussion. I'll note that we're almost at halfway through the hour. So it seems that we're still in agreement to use Google Doc. There was a suggestion to close the doc 6 hours before, but there was also a suggestion of warning that the doc will close 24 hours ahead of the meeting, 18 hours, sending a notice, 24 hours ahead of the meeting, that 18 hours before the doc is locked. So that way it would still be locked at 6 hours, but staff would send a notice, which we can do. And then also to use comments, not crossouts, noting, however, that in some cases that's going to be perhaps more laborious for drafting, and for just minor edits it might make more sense to be able to do those edits. And staff will look into the possibility of being able to see the original without the edits. And I see Christine has her hand up. Please go ahead, Christine.
Thanks. This is Christine. I support all of these suggestions. I just wanted to clarify my little, like, sending a tickler thing. I know that you guys usually send, I think Julie sends a reminder about the call a day ahead, and I'm not necessarily saying you even have to, like, send a second email, but as maybe in bold, as a reminder, this doc will close in, you know, X number of hours, which gets you to 6 hours before the call. So that's basically it, just a little highlight, because we do get that the meeting is coming tickler. It would maybe be helpful if we're reminded, oh, that's right, in this working group, you know, our doc closes early. So we just, that was my only suggestion there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Christine. Kathy, please go ahead.
I know it will be rejected, but I think it's much fairer to close the document 24 hours before the call, giving everybody equal chance to participate in it. Otherwise, I think the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S. are going to wake up, and particularly, I think it's actually particularly unfair for those of us bringing children to school. We just won't be able to look at this document or the edits that come in the night before. So I think it would be fair if everyone had the same opportunity to look at the final round of edits or comments in this case, and we closed it so that no one's surprised when they wake up or get to work. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. And Lori, you're next.
Hi, yeah. So I had put into chat a couple of things. One is maybe in terms of the redlining issue, that if we're there to correct spelling or a typographical error or grammar, that would be fine to redline, because I think that might be what Michael's referring to, like when it should or shouldn't have an apostrophe kind of a thing. That could save time. I mean, the group is small enough that I think remembering that rule wouldn't be difficult. One way to maybe cut down on some of that post-meeting editing. And then to Kathy's point, you know, maybe 12 hours is right. I don't know what the magic number is, but I do think that a full day before probably doesn't correspond to how most people review the work. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Lori. This is Julie Hedlund from staff then. So suggesting a lockout of 12 hours, that seems there's some agreement to that. So staff can send a reminder with the agenda, noting that there will be a lockout at 12 hours. can use comments rather than strikeout, except as Lori notes, for perhaps minor edits. And just noting from Mary Wong in chat to Kurt, do you also want to limit edits of questions already discussed to the lead and staff with questions yet to be discussed, reverting to step one?
So it seems, this is Kurt. Thanks, Mary. So it seems that the edits should be somewhat agreed to during the discussion, right? So the purpose of, and it's, and we're actually blessed to be in kind of a small group, but the purpose of the meetings is to discuss the questions and come to some sort of agreement as to what they should read. And then, you know, I guess it's right during the call, you know, if it's my section, I'll say, I'll make those changes, or Mary will say, you know, someone on the an ICANN staff member can make those changes, or Kathy would say, so since everybody agrees, Kurt, I'm going to make those changes. You know, it's like a 10-second discussion for each change about who makes it, something like that. We can be collaborative and probably more effective because we'll be flexible in that way.
Thank you, Kurt. And I see Lori and Christine. Lori?
That's an old hand. I'm sorry.
Christine?
I think this is Christine. I wanted to say what Kurt said, but slightly more forcefully, and that is, I think we've sort of decided that we, after we've gone through a section, it is more or less close. I mean, I know we're going to do a final review at the end and make sure that it all kind of aligns, and there's nothing that we did in Section 6 that we should go back and, gosh, we really need to write that in Section 1, you know, for some continuity. But I would like to say that when we're done with a section and we've hashed it out for 4 or 5 weeks, I would like to say that we're done. And, you know, we were pretty happy with that. We know that this isn't the final version of questions. We know this is going out not only to the full working group, but also to the survey providers. So, I would really be opposed to, you know, digging through and anybody just randomly going in and changing stuff that we've already agreed to on calls. Thanks.
Thank you, Christine. So just to try to close this out and move ahead to finish up Michael's section, we have a reminder that there'll be a lockout that can go out along with the agenda, locking out 12 hours before. Use comments rather than strikeout except for very minor edits. Limit edits of questions already discussed to the lead and staff. Questions yet to be discussed, reverting to step one. Then, and also I'll just note the action, too, that staff will look into whether or not there's an option to view sort of clean versus red line. Is there anything, does anybody else have any other comments before we move back to Michael? Thank you, everyone. And Michael, then we'll turn it over to you to switch to where we left off with your questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Michael Graham for the record. And to repeat the question that I asked Mary over by email, where we stopped the last time, my brain and my body both just back from vacation. So I think we were at beginning question 4. Is that correct, or have we moved on beyond that?
Michael, this is Julie Headland from staff. I think we were at page, let's see, pardon me for not having this right up on top. Pages, we were, there are two questions left to close out the trademark brand owner section. That's the cease and desist letters and brand owner experiences regarding evidence of harm. So that's pages 18 through 20 in the document. So, for instance, if I were to sync this and move us to that, let me go ahead and do that.
I'm just seeing a portion of the document on my screen.
Yeah, actually,
There, I've made it smaller, so people should actually be able to see. Okay, so I think you're right, and that let's move to question, looking at question four. Okay, that's sorry. Yes, obtain owner feedback on brand owner experiences regarding evidence of harm. But then also, right. So, and Ariel, can you just correct me if I'm – okay, Ariel has her hand up. Please go ahead. I want to make sure we're in the right spot.
Thanks, Julie. Apologies. So the PDF is the page is not in sync with the Google Docs. So if you look at the PDF, it should be the bottom of page 24. It's about deceased and deceased questions.
There we go.
If you look at Google Docs, that's page 18 at the bottom.
Yeah. Thank you, Ariel. Michael again. And let's see. Do you have control then over the page? So the question the purpose is to obtain feedback on the number of cease and desist letters sent, and that's pursuant to the claims charter. And then the relevant charter question, I can't see the second part of the page on 25. Does a trademark claims notice to domain, name applicants meet its intended purpose question? And then it's, if not, is it intimidating, hard to understand, or otherwise inadequate? If inadequate, how can it be improved? And then there's a further sub-question, whether does it inform domain name applicants of the scope and limitations of, I believe, of the claim service? Oh, wait a minute. I can go down now. Thank you.
Now, this is Julie from staff. I've unsynced the document, if that's easier, so that everybody can scroll along. Or if you prefer, I can leave it synced. Kathy has her hand up, though.
Oh, Kathy?
Yeah, I don't see how the cease and desist letters questions correspond to the charter questions. The charter questions seem pretty clear here about the trademark claims. The cease and desist, I don't seem to belong here. It doesn't seem to have been something. I don't even remember it being something that the working group talked about or that the initial sub-team talked about. And I think here it's somewhat leading. You can, of course, send – I mean, we're talking about trademark notice, and you can, of course, send a cease and desist letter, legitimate or not, and you can be upset if someone doesn't respond or responds with a no, legitimate or not, and we're not exploring any of that here, and I think it would be far too detailed for us to do it. And again, I don't see a correspondence to the charter questions. I think we're going way beyond our initial scope. Thanks.
Michael, I'm having trouble navigating the document, I guess. Back to there.
I can go ahead and this is Julie from staff. I can sync it and navigate it for you. So it's hard because we're right at a crossover of a page, and then we have some sort of information. So it is hard to read. And so does that help? Is that can you read that okay so we can see the text on both 24 and into page 25?
Okay, yeah, now I've got it. Thank you.
Great. And I see Christine has her hand up.
Christine, go ahead.
Hey, thanks. This is Christine for the record. I just wanted to address Kathy's point, and I think I agree with you. Your point's well taken. If we just want to remember that the far left column, purpose and scope, was the co-chair drafted list of questions that was presented to the GNSO Council for the purposes of obtaining to do the survey. So as I recall, the co-chairs themselves kind of summarized what each of these groups of questions were to ask. And so what we had done was we had asked staff to go in and say, for the specific questions that the co-chairs put to the GNSO Council, we wanted them mapped back against the charter questions. And I think this is that charter question. I agree that perhaps the question that was presented or the statement that was presented to the GNSO Council was less than detailed here, but I think we want to focus really on the meat of it, which is the charter question, which is in the second from the left column. Does the trademark claims notice to domain name applicants meet its intended purpose? And when I'm clear, when I say that, I mean the charter question as rewritten and rescoped by the entire sub-team is in the second from the left column. And in this specific case, I recommend that we just focus on that language and make sure that our actual survey questions map to the charter question, not just the little summary question on the far left, if that's acceptable to everyone else. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. This is Michael, and for the record, I agree. I think part of the work that we did on the relevant charter questions and retooling those and looking at them was to really focus in on what we were trying to get at, and here trying to get at the effectiveness of claims notices, how much they're used, et cetera. So moving from that then into the actual anecdotal questions that we have next. The first anecdotal question, Rebecca, you've got your hand up.
Thank you very much. I wonder if one way to address Kathy's question and also to get more designer input into this would be to just switch it to, what did you do in response to the claims notice or notices, right? Ask them as many times as there were different responses. So I take it that, if the thing worked perfectly, then you would never actually get a claims notice because all the infringers would be deterred. Then there are some people who go on anyway, and you want to evaluate that. So it may be that the appropriate reaction is for most of those is to do nothing because maybe there isn't a problem for whatever reason. So I guess sort of leaving it more open-ended might allow the survey expert to do some input and also allow us to collect whatever information happens to be out there about what effect getting a claims notice had. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Kathy, before I call on you, I see your hand is up. Let me just respond to Rebecca. So I think your point is well taken, and in fact, we've anticipated that because if you look at the data questions, which is what we want to get to, they follow that line of questioning that you've suggested, the first question being, how many claims notices have you received for your trademarks? The next question, how many of these claims notices did you follow with a cease and desist letter? That's followed by, how many times did the applicant agree to abandon its application? And I suppose that should have inserted in it as a result of your cease and desist letter. Followed by how many times did the applicant refuse to abandon its application? And then that's followed by how many URS, UDRP, or other actions did you file against applicants that refused to abandon their applications based on likelihood of confusion, cyber squatting, or bad faith? My suggestion with that last one would be that we remove that last based on phrase to the end. That's getting into some matters that would require the trademark owner to determine which of those were the grounds based on which the applicants refused. I mean, it's just confusing, and the question really is, how many claims did you get? How many cease and desist letters did you send out? How many people, how many applicants abandoned their applications before going further, and basically how many actions did you have to bring because they did not? Kathy, you want to go ahead? I'm sorry.
Actually, it looks like Rebecca wants to respond, so why don't I wait? Would that make sense?
Okay.
Okay.
Rebecca?
Thank you, Rebecca Toshnet. I guess the reason I did review those questions and the reason I suggested something more open-ended was, I think we should be open to other possibilities. So as I understand it, the claims notice actually holds out the prospect that, in fact, the use might be fine. Perhaps it's you know, it's hotel or, you know, one of these top 10 names that is in the TMCH, or maybe it's a personal name and the registrant actually has that name, you know. So the questions don't sort of ask, you know, did you leave it alone? And if so, why? And I think rather than fighting about wording, that's why I suggest sort of waiting for the survey expert to say to talk about the details of what happened then. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Kathy?
Sorry, coming off mute. Right, so I think the recommendation, Michael, is to delete, is to keep column 3. So looking at column 2 and keeping and looking at column 3, there's a close correspondence. They're asking about the trademark claims notice. But and that seems to make sense. So a trademark owner's perspective on both the trademark claims notice, and I think we should – we probably have to come up with a different word. The notice – there's a notice that goes to the – potential registrant that the trademark owner may be receiving, and then also the notice that comes from the TMCH database to the trademark owner if someone registers something in the TMCH. We may want to come up with different terms to define that because I think we're asking about both. But in terms of column 4, I think the proposal on the table, Michael, is to delete those questions, anything with the word cease and desist. There may have been, and replace it with what did you do in response? Because there may have been many things. Somebody may have picked up the phone. They may have sent a cease and desist letter. They may have sent a regular letter. They may have sent an attorney across the street. So replacing anything that says cease and desist with what did you do in response? And then given the detail that we're going to get into for the registering questions later, I would say, and what was the domain name? So that we have some sense of the domain name in question, because we'll be asking that a lot later in terms of our data gathering. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. And I think you've got a great point there in that there are two types of notices, and we need to make those clear. I don't know if there's an accepted terminology that we could adopt. And then we also have the issue of, you know, the survey going out to make clear to the survey takers what they're responding to. And I think that's a really, really good drafting point that we ought to take a look at before the next time what the language may be. As to the point of open-ended questions, I think there's a great point there, too. As you point out, that column 3 is more open-ended. And let me run through that really quickly because I think that's another part of the question. And this is really asking for anecdotal responses rather than empirical responses. So the first question that we've got there is based on your experience, do you believe the trademark, and again, this is directed to trademark owners and brand owners. Based on your experience, do you believe the trademark claims notice to domain name applicants has itself met its intended purpose? And then there's a note following that. Again, we might want to explain here what that purpose is said to be in the applicant's guidebook and also provide a copy. And I suppose that's referring to a copy of that statement of purpose for the review of the person who's looking at it. It might be easier to just put that into simple words, you know, what is the purpose according to the guidebook, and insert that here. I don't have it in front of me right now. Rebecca, is your hand still up, or did you put it up again? Not sure. And Kathy, I see your hand is up as well.
Sorry, my hand should be down.
Oh, okay. Okay,
thanks,
so I think that needs to be revised at the end there to provide that information. The second question was, if you do not believe it has met its intended purpose, can you say why you believe this? Or I suppose, you know, I think the question is fine. If we get too much wordsmithing, you know, we're taking away, obviously, we're just, again, trying to give some guidance to the survey designer. Otherwise, I'd say, why do you believe this, is all I would say. The next question is the claims notice hard to understand or otherwise inadequate? And I suppose, to go back to your point, Kathy, that should be, is the trademark claims notice sent to applicants hard to understand or otherwise inadequate? That's really what's being asked there. And at that point, let me just stop and see if anyone has a good suggestion what the accepted term, let's say, should or terms we should use for the trademark claims notice that goes to applicants and the, I don't know what it's called, the notice of continued application that goes out to, or I guess the notice of registration that goes out to trademark owners once one of these registers, if it does. Anyone have a suggestion what terminology we might use in the questions that would make it clearer what we're asking?
Michael, this is Lori.
Go ahead, Lori.
Hi, I don't think I'm directly answering your question. Yeah, I don't think I'm directly answering your question, but I have a comment, and that is to the adequacy of the notice. This is only going to trademark owners, correct? That's where we are, to trademark owners, because if that's the case, I agree with something that Jay Scott put into the chat about why are we asking trademark owners if it's confusing, or why are we asking trademark owners about if they understand it? Or do you think what we're really asking is this a good tool? Is this the right tool? I'm a little concerned about getting so into the weeds and asking a question that would be difficult for someone to answer. Well, what would an adequate one look like? It's like asking them to redraft the notice. I don't know if that's fair.
So, thanks, Lori. I think that's a good point.
Maybe I could just follow up, and maybe we go super hyper simple and say, do the communications that you receive from the trademark clearinghouse make sense? How have you reacted to them? Call them communications. Maybe not even give them the official name that we give them.
Mm-hmm.
Because these at their very heart are communications, and we're trying to find out, are we communicating effectively? And are we communicating in a way that alerts people without traumatizing people, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, Lori, Michael, I think that's a great point because, again, and I guess this is where I will admit to it, too, in phrasing these questions of adopting and learning the language of the country in which we're living, of ICANN, and moving outside of that, trademark owners who are not spending their 24/7 with ICANN matters may not understand, and certainly communications from the Trademark Clearinghouse would make it clear, hey, is there anything that you're receiving from them? Is it clear? Is it not clear? Do you not receive anything? Open-ended question. I think if I can go back then after this call and rephrase that question there, and address in that way, that's the direction I would go with it.
Yeah, I mean, my point is, because this is, again, I'm going to go to the learnings from the INTA survey. The more technical we try to get, the more we're going to turn respondents off, even well-informed ones.
Great. And I think addressing that as well, if I can go back to the earlier discussion of, I think Kathy was brought up, of making the questions more broad on the data questions rather than having it follow with a cease and desist letter. Let me go back and rework that so that it is more, how many of these claims notices did you follow up with some action? And then what action did you take? And I think then we would have to list some of the possible actions, and it would be sort of I presume that when it got to the survey creator, they might make of it a multiple choice sort of thing that you could indicate which ones. The problem with that, which again makes it more complicated, is that then we would go on and ask the trademark owner, well, how many of each did you do? Obviously that information becomes more vague or more difficult to obtain over time, but hopefully that would address both of the issues so that it's broad enough, it's not limited to cease and desist letters, and it gets the information that we want. How much through reading those. Then at the bottom there was another question in the third column. Does the claims notice inform domain name applicants of the scope and limitations of trademark owners' rights? If not, how can it be improved? And that's the one that, you know, I think we'd have to give them a copy of that notice and have them take a look at it. Frankly, I don't think most trademark owners know or may be instantly aware of what's in that. Certainly, I'd question whether or not they would be able to answer that question. Maybe that more general question you were suggesting, Lori, would be a better way to go. Christine? Your hands up.
Hi, thanks. This is Christine for the transcript. I also support a more general question, but I wanted to kind of even back it up a little bit because I think that in this case, we are asking, this is sort of like asking registry operators if their pricing is bad for registrants. I think asking a brand owner if the trademark claims notice to registrants is bad or ineffective or hard to be clear, I mean, I think that that's a little bit tough. I think what we really want to ask here from a high level is, excuse me, going back to the sort of the list of data questions that Michael had was, you know, of the letters you got, how many cease and desist letters, et cetera, take it back up and say, you know, when you sent letters, tell me about these experiences you had. Were the people confused? Were they baffled? Were they shocked and appalled? Like, we want to know, we're trying to get in this specific instance some anecdotal evidence about why, about how brand owners interacted with or thought the claims notice went for registrants. In some cases, the brand owner themselves was a registrant and may have also received claims notices because there's many brands that you know, exist in the same universe. But then, in this case, we want to find out, can the brand owners report dealing with registrants that were just confused? And were they frustrated? Did they think to themselves, gosh, you know, it would be really great if these claims notices said this or that, or that would really help the registrants, it would really make my job easier as a brand owner in getting these claims notices, like, and really putting people on notice. That's what I think we're getting at here. Not really, you know, the brand owners trying to clairvoyantly figure out, you know, how a registrant interpreted the claims notice, but what was their actual interactions? Thanks.
Great, and I wanted to go back real quick while I'm thinking of it. Mary came up with the terminology, which I think we all adopt, NORN and claims notice, obviously being clear on that. And then addressing what you were just saying, Christine, I think that's an excellent point, leaving out or removing the questions about the content of the claims notice and instead asking about the reaction to, or their observations about reactions to the cease and desist or other action that they took from the trademark owners on behalf of the actions and responses by the applicants so that we can get that feedback. And I'm sorry, I think we're over our time, if I'm not wrong. We only had 60 minutes for this. Our next meeting, I take it, will be next Friday, Mary?
This is Julie Hedlund from staff. Actually, the next meeting, we're rotating the times. So based on the last doodle poll, the next meeting will be next Thursday, the 11th of January at 2200 UTC.
Okay.
And wait a second. What time Eastern is that, please? This is Kathy.
5 o'clock.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. And after this call, I'll go back and revise these questions under question 3 pursuant to our discussion today and pick up with my brain back intact, hopefully, on Thursday. So thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, staff, for helping guide us through the use of the Google documents, and I think we've got some good guidelines there. And let me just ask that you send those out again just in a quick email form to the group so that we all have those in front of us when we're looking at the Google Doc this week. I will have my revisions in by noon on Saturday, so that after that, anyone who wants to make any revisions or questions to that question 3 and beyond can do so. Thanks a lot. Have a great day. And, oh, by the way, Happy New Year.
Thanks, everyone. Happy New
Year. Okay, I think we're going to stop the recording then, Ariel. Or Julie, whoever's in charge.
Thank you so much. Operator, you can disconnect the recording and all remaining lines. Meeting has been adjourned. Have a great day, everyone.
Thanks.